So the three of us have experienced robotaxi. You've done how many rides?
13.
I think I've done 14, and you've
I've
done.
done three.
So you're the newbie of the three of
I'm the
us.
newbie.
Yeah. We'll start with you, actually, Larry. So you flew in yesterday, was it?
Yeah.
Okay. For those that are not familiar that are watching this podcast, we're all have been following Tesla for a really long time. All three of us got access to the beta, the Robotaxi beta, the Robotaxi early release, and we've had some exposure to it, and we have a lot of thoughts to share. We're recording from the Capital Factory podcast room, so shout out Capital Factory. Thank you so much for helping us accommodate for a last second podcast, even though we can't get the camera to work, but that's okay. We use our own camera. Maybe for tomorrow we get it to work. Larry, we'll start with you. So high level thoughts, and then we'll drill down. So.
Hey guys, real quick, we had a technical issue with Larry's mic. I tried my best to edit and make it sound as good as possible. I think it's pretty good given what we had, but I do want to let you know that there's a ton of very, very valuable information that was shared, but it should still be good enough for y'all to enjoy the content. So just a heads up. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with the smoothness and effortlessness of the ride. The very convenient pull-up point, if you've driven in Waymos before, you probably have to walk across the block or around the corner or into the road to get on into the Waymo.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's going to be permanent, but the robotaxi came up very conveniently, parked near where we were. It was really well organized, really smooth. The whole experience was effortless.
Yeah.
And, I came from an Uber. I'd taken an Uber from the airport to the hotel and a Uber from the hotel to get my ride. And the reason being that I had a hotel that was outside the zone. But I mean, getting into an Uber with a real driver is such friction. I reached a point that I will not take an Uber that is below the highest level, the Premier ride. And that sucker, they talk about a dollar a mile, the target being a dollar a mile
Yeah.
for robotaxi. Well, Uber is supposedly $4 a mile. Unless you have to get the Premier, it's $16 a mile. That's what it cost me this morning.
Wow.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
So what, talk about that friction. So what's that friction you're talking about when hailing an Uber?
I mean, firstly, every driver has a different kind of thing. I mean,
Quirks.
quirks, yeah. Some have a delightful aroma about them. Some have got, a lack of understanding of the English language, and some are just outright rude. And you don't feel good about rating them below five because, like, five is the gating factor, and so you don't want to, do
Yeah.
anything.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, that they're going to rate you five because otherwise, and so you get this situation that you don't know what you're getting into. Last time I was in Austin, and we're talking from Austin now, and last time I was in Austin, I come every couple of weeks, as you know.
Yep. Yep.
I called a Premier, and it was a big black SUV. The only thing is, this thing had like 160,000 miles, and they hadn't changed the shocks on it. It was the worst ride of my life. I was ill by the time I arrived at the airport, and I'm not one to get tossing. Anyway.
Yeah.
The point is, you don't know what you're getting into. There's a lot of anxiety before you get into it, and then the anxiety abates if you're in a really good car
Yeah.
and somebody drives well and so on and so
So
forth.
even if you pick a certain category on Uber, there's still an inconsistency of the level of sort of like if you're paying for Premier, you're not always going to get a Premier experience.
No,
Yeah.
you're really not going to get a Premier experience.
Yeah.
And it's the luck of the draw, like the guy got into a car with one day. It's a long ride at St. Pete when we
Yeah.
drove to the
I remember this. Yeah,
I
in the
called
Mercedes.
and the same guy picked me up, and he said, "You're going to the airport?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Did you pick Premier?" I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Okay, then we can go." If it's
Interesting.
not Premier, he wasn't prepared ride all the way to the airport from St. Pete.
Oh, really?
They're going to pitch me out of the car.
Wow.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wow.
So you don't know what you're getting into. Anyway, we drive a mile into the zone where they're running this ADA or this introduction to the hotel where my good friend Brad Ferguson is hanging out waiting for me. And 1 mile, $16.
Wow.
So the $4 a mile or the $1, I mean, it we're nowhere there.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the old days when we used to pick up a taxi, do you remember the crud and the nasty cabs that
sure.
you drive in and how expensive they were? And you never knew
yeah.
what you were going to get.
And the driver had their seat all the way back, so you could barely fit in the back seat.
Yeah. Well, you know,
yeah.
I mean, we're at that point with Uber that the
gotcha.
Experience has gone down.
Yeah.
But you get into this beautiful car, very comfortable, very quiet, and it is so smooth driving.
You're talking about the robo-taxi now.
Robo-taxi.
Yeah.
You get into this robo-taxi, and it's like heaven on earth if you have to do these damn Ubers, you know, wherever you go. So, yeah, I'm a fan.
Yeah.
I'm an absolute fan, and it went so well. You know, we only did 3 drives this morning. But one drive we took, you know, it was like a 25-minute drive, you know, through some really hairy traffic and really hairy traffic situation.
Yeah.
Handled it like a king.
So you have ridden 13 times. So you've ridden a little bit more than Larry has. So what would you piggyback on anything that he said? Do you want to add anything to what was said from your perspective?
Well, I thought he made a lot of good points about the Uber experience. The other thing I was going to add is like they're always doing something with their phone, like checking their phone,
yeah.
calling someone, like secretly watching something. Like yeah. they're always doing something with the phone. Like, yeah. So I feel like that's another angle to it. And what's really interesting is Waymo is launched in Austin, but Waymo, you have to request through Uber. Because it's an Uber partnership. So all these people are trying to get Waymos, but then they just get a crappy Uber, which is, to me, it's like Waymo is ruining its consumer experience. This is like a no-brainer. You came out with the coolest thing ever from the future. People want to pay you for it,
yeah.
but now you've pigeonholed it in this Uber app where they could also get the shittiest version of that experience ever.
And it's just like, to clarify what? That for the audience, so in Austin specifically, you can't hail a Waymo through the Waymo app. You have to do it through Uber, but you can't specifically ask for a Waymo. You have to go through the regular Uber experience, and then you might get paired with a Waymo,
yeah.
right? I just want to make sure that's like exactly. you can't outright call for a Waymo.
Yeah.
You have to be paired by the luck of the draw and the availability and who's willing to take that ride, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure that was
yeah, and just that. But that's it. I feel like that's such a fumble of the bag by Google yeah. and Waymo, because with Robotaxi, you know you're getting that Robotaxi experience every time, and also seeing the Waymo next to the Robotaxi has been a big eye-opener for me of, like, this looks so Frankenstein and janky, and, like, you immediately feel like you're using, like, a clunky, like, Windows Vista 1990 robo-taxi is, like, the new Mac. That's, like, how it feels with, you know, it kind of feels like surpassed them. So I haven't even tried a Waymo in Austin because I haven't been able to get one. I've been doing Ubers, but...
Yeah.
So I selected electric. You know, you got all those categories.
Oh, that'll help you, yeah.
I selected electric, and I got a Waymo first try. And so I don't know if I was lucky or the way to go, but that's what I did. And I got the Waymo, and it arrived. The only thing is it stopped in the middle of on the side of the road in a 4-lane road, which means that it's hogging the right turn lane. So I had to get there really quickly in case, you know, there was a buildup of traffic. I mean, why not just pull into the hotel, you know?
Interesting. Okay.
And then in the car, I mean, you know, it's a Jaguar I-Pace. I mean, it's a miserable car. It's like a car from the 60s, you know, kind of electric car wannabe.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they'll get over that, you know, and they'll fix that. But the jerkiness told me that this is a coded solution. This is not an end-to-end neural net.
Yeah, so talk about that riding experience in the Waymo as compared to the robotaxi.
It's a very pleasant riding experience. I will not denigrate it, but it doesn't have the smoothness of the Tesla. It reminds me of the old version 11 of FSD before they went end-to-end neural net. I will say that the old 11, version 11, was a little bit more jerky. This is a little bit, this is smoother than the old 11, but it's still got the same, you know, you see the steering wheel jerk as it's getting, you know, the vectors are being fed in, you know, step by step by step by step.
Yeah.
And so you can almost watch the code running on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, and because of that, you get these hesitations around the corner where you kind of, the guy decides,
yeah.
So it doesn't have the gliding, you know, impression that you get from the Tesla.
Yeah.
Robotaxi. So, I mean, look, I'm a, you know, big Tesla fan, big Tesla investor, and so I obviously have a, I'm bent that way.
Sure.
But there's no comparison in the experience. None at all.
Yeah. I think that's one thing that I've been trying really hard to square, because I am, you know, if I speak from my perspective, I am very clearly biased towards Tesla because I'm an investor, fan, work there, et cetera, et cetera. But then at the same time, it's like trying my hardest to just view things factually. And then when I land on, like, where I continually land is, yes, is does Tesla still have to iron out some things with the service? Obviously. Do they still need to remove the safety driver or rider? Obviously. Do they need to expand the geofence area? Obviously. Do they have to add more cars to the network? Obviously. But compare the trend of where the company has gone through to where their scale is going to take them. And just fast forward the story 3 to 5 years from now. And I think the inescapable reality is that Tesla is the only one that can do this at scale. And I don't think that's like a fanboy statement. I don't think that's like a all you think about is Tesla statement. I think that's a very factual statement, because there's no other manufacturer of self-driving vehicles that can get anywhere close to 1 million units per year, which is what that vehicle that we've been driving around in Austin is, which is the Tesla Model Y. And then with CyberCab on top of that, is likely going to double or triple that in the coming years, right? And so if I'm thinking about it through that lens, to me, it just feels like it doesn't matter what the other auto manufacturers do from a scale perspective in the next 3 to 5 years, because it's going to be impossible for anybody to get to 1 million unit run rate with a self-driving car with a cost structure that's not going to blow out their ability to create a profit, right? Using the end-to-end neural networks and the cameras. So to me, there's only one player that can make those cars, and then everybody else will have to go through Uber or something, because they're not going to have enough cars at scale to service an area. They're going to have to go with an aggregator. The problem with the aggregator in Uber is that if they do take that on, they will have to artificially keep their prices high so that their drivers don't leave the network. Because if they start offering the real price of a self-driving car, all of a sudden, your network collapses, because the guys that get paid to drive can no longer compete. And the way that Uber brings drivers onto the network is by increasing the price so that drivers have an incentive to go on the network. So it's almost like self-driving cars that can't scale will accelerate Uber's demise, because it will artificially keep prices higher than they should be to keep the drivers on the network. Because those self-driving companies don't have enough scale to service those many regions that Tesla's going to access with their scale, right? Is this, like, am I thinking about this incorrectly? Like, help me.
Yeah, on target. I agree with that. I think that there's another factor that you're not touching, and that's infrastructure. So if you look at the infrastructure that, you know, that Tesla already has globally, but particularly in the U.S., they have 400 locations in the United States, 200 of them service locations. They have the kind of management in every city, minor and major city in this country. They're there. Waymo has nothing like that, and Uber even has nothing like that.
Yeah.
Uber have, you know, they have call centers, they have, you know, and their call center is central. have a few connections in service centers that they contract out to people who have had no experience with electric cars or chargers or anything. But Tesla's got it all. So if you take these advantages, you're looking at a very, very considerable, there's no comparison to where the two companies are. So I'm very confident that we'll see a rollout during 2025 of the service to a level of demand that will be very robust. And next year, we'll see a breakout year for this service. I'm pretty confident.
Yeah.
And even if that gets delayed too, like I'm thinking through it, like let's say they do hit snags where the corner cases are difficult and they aren't able to reach the confidence level around like the drop-offs, like getting them consistent, you know, getting the interventions down to a level where they can yank the safety rider so they can go at scale and not have every car with a driver in there, right? Let's say that's delayed. The truth will still hold that they are the only ones that can manufacture these in the millions of units per year. So it almost doesn't matter if it's this year or next year or 2027. I don't see a pathway for other manufacturers to reach that scale anytime in the near to medium term, even the long term, based on Tesla's positioning today. Right? So it's almost like it's been written in stone, and it's just a matter of time for this to actually happen. And the timing of it is irrelevant. It's more about like who has captured the future scale for this platform to go into cities and regions and suburbs and rural areas and between cities and, you know, between states. There's only one company that can do that. There's only one company that can do that. So I don't know. It's been a very eye-opening experience for me, like these few days. It's like it has been boring so often, but I still see the edges. I still see the corner cases that they have to deal with. So that tempers my expectation from a timing perspective. But like the way you guys started the conversation, it wasn't even about necessarily the technology that they've achieved. It was the experience. It was the product. The product is what's going to separate the company from everybody else. It's the, I'm going to be able to go from point A to point B cheaper than Uber, and I have the car to myself, and it's air conditioned, and I have a screen, and it plays the music I was listening to already, and it's connected to my Netflix account, and I have it all to myself, right? And it's going to be super smooth, and it's a smooth ride, and it's consistent. Like that is a killer product. That's a killer product, you know? And there's only one company that can do that, it seems. You know? So I don't know.
Yeah, I think Waymo's got its work cut out for it. I think Waymo has a very significant technology challenge, and they have a very significant product challenge in terms of cost, and they have a very significant infrastructure and support challenge.
Yeah.
Other than that, they're golden.
Yeah. Other than that, I mean, it is a very cool product. I mean, it truly is. Like, it's very cool seeing, as ugly as they are, it's like very cool seeing them floating around the city, because the city feels very futuristic.
Yeah, and it's got this big light at the top of it.
Yeah.
And it puts your initials.
Yeah, that's cool.
Drives up.
Yeah.
So there's some cool aspects.
It's very cool.
And I mean, they had no safety driver.
Exactly.
So as much as, you know, we're all Tesla fans, you got to give credit where credit's due.
100%.
Yeah, they don't have anybody in the front seat yet.
They had safety drivers for almost 3 years.
Uh-huh.
When they introduced in Arizona, they had a safety driver for almost 3 years. They had a safety driver in San Francisco for over a year, was it? Over or under a year. So they've had, you know, safety drivers. Austin, I believe, was the first city where they introduced without safety drivers, but they had a very long test period going before they introduced
it. Yeah. Hmm. And that's mostly because regulations here allow the manufacturer or the company to launch without a safety driver. It's like, it's very, and there's no requirement. Like the state, Gally and I were talking about this earlier, the state, like, they let you do what you want, and then the second you get into a mistake, they'll slap your wrists. But it's a statewide regulation framework that basically allows any company to operate an AV safely without a safety driver. And the onus is on the company to ensure that they're doing that safely. And if they start getting into trouble, that's when the state comes down and says, okay, you're getting into trouble. So And that's one benefit Tesla has here in Austin. So what that tells me is if Tesla is really going down the path of, like, you were talking about the 0 to 1 moment, like before we went live, the last 8 years that Tesla has done, the work they've put in to go from Navigate on autopilot to FSD to Robotaxi, those 8 years, on Sunday, it came alive, right? That was 8 years worth of work. Now to get to, okay, let's go to North Austin, the suburbs, between the cities, maybe between the states, the pace at which we reach that will be significantly faster than the pace of going from Navigate on autopilot to FSD. And so that expansion will feel very fast, but it's only enabled because the last 8 years, Tesla has been working massively to enable that scale. And that was what the neural net end-to-end approach was.
Yeah, the other factor I should mention, which I think is important, I don't know, but I'm guessing, is the size of Cortex. You know, Cortex has only just come into full production. And that's Cortex 1.
Yeah.
But have you guys seen the size of Cortex 2?
It's pretty big.
It's not pretty big.
It's damn big.
I was going to use a different word, but it's
fucking big.
It is. You're the only one allowed.
It's my channel, damn it.
I mean, it is gigantic.
And for the audience that's not familiar, what is Cortex?
So Cortex is the AI computers, the AI cluster. It's the data center in which they train this end-to-end neural net. And, you know, Cortex only came online just very recently, probably in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, the scale, one of the things we've learned about AI, and we keep being taught this lesson, it's called the bitter lesson, for a reason. One of the things we know about AI now, we know almost certainly, is that more is better. More compute, better.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. We just can't get away from it. I know that, you know, a lot of the AI companies have played with improving this and improving that, and, you know, but at the end of the day, more is better.
Yeah.
And we now know that, and we can't get away from it. So when you look at Cortex, where it is right now in terms of total floor area, this Cortex 2 absolutely dwarfs it. I mean Dorset. Cortex 2 is so big that it is larger than all the other buildings surrounding the main building at Giga Texas.
Wow.
It is gigantic.
Is it the second biggest structure outside of Giga Texas, like the actual factory?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's second only to the big factory.
Yeah.
And is, of course, you know, it's the largest factory in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, but it has three levels. Giga Texas has three levels.
Yeah.
So Cortex 2 is only one level, flat, and it's got a, you know, just a flat roof.
Yeah.
But it is huge.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge.
How many GPUs?
Nobody's telling us. Nobody knows. Nobody's telling us.
Yeah.
But I think the technical term is a bunch.
A shitload. There we go again.
Yeah.
There we go again. Yeah.
I can't let my children watch your.
Yeah, it is fascinating to see just how, so like that bitter lesson sort of like mantra that's being thrown around now with AI. Just to give a little bit of context, basically what that is for the audience is the it's like, it's kind of like you have to brute force it in a way, where you just have to have so much training compute so that you can give it all the data possible for it to figure out what the right parameters are for the inference computer to make the decisions. So basically, it's basically like, imagine your brain. The idea behind this is like the equivalent of somebody dumping the world's knowledge into your brain and then allowing your brain to think about your brain having a ton, like the greatest brain in the world, like the most powerful brain in the world. You let the brain figure out all the connections and how to make sense of all the data, and then that, the result, then gets fed to the cars, and then in theory those cars will then have a very distilled, usable version of the world's like the world's data that you have learned. So, and the thought process there is the more variables you introduce for that big brain to make a decision, that improves the output. But you can only do that realistically by having so many freaking chips working at the same time so that it doesn't take you 10 years to run that training process. You can actually have it back in like a matter of months or weeks. And so the more GPUs you have, the bigger the cluster is, the more likely it is that you're able to process vast amounts of data. So why is that useful for self-driving? If you think about when we drive in the road and we're like manually driving, we're taking in so much data, right? There's so much coming at our eyes, our ears, the way we feel the road, et cetera, et cetera. All those are variables that our brains have just become unbelievably good at processing. And then we make decisions on, some of us do, some of us are, you know, just on our phone and then we hit somebody, right? But the ones that are actually paying attention. So it's exactly the same way. You're maximizing the number of variables that the self-driving car can process. But you do that by having a gigantic training computer. And the bigger your training computer, the more variables you can take in. And then the art form becomes, over time, how good can you get at distilling that knowledge so that you can throw it to the car computer to process that data. And there's a lot of work there. And the more data you have, the more you can distill, because you can get down to the key variables that you need to make decisions. But you can only get there if you feed it as much data as possible so you can rule out all the different parameters and variables that you shouldn't be paying attention to, but also the ones that you should be paying attention to. That's like a very dumbed down, layman version of what's going on. I'm sure I missed a few things there, but I just, for the audience, so they fully understand why this better lesson thing is so important, you have to have a ton of compute. And it seems like Elon and a handful of other players have learned that lesson, and they're going all in, right? Yeah. And it takes a lot of capital to do that.
I have a question for Gadi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm an avid watcher of your videos, have been for years.
Did you like to subscribe?
I think I did. So when Gadi produced Patreon, I was one of his early Patreons.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome.
But you're a very timid driver, if I may say so.
Yeah. Cautious. Safe.
Safe.
I call it grandma.
Grandma. Yeah,
I call it timid. All right, safe. So how do you feel about FSD now?
Well, on my 5-year-old Model Y, I've been using it all the time, which I think is a really good sign. Like, even just my super simple tech investor brain, I'm like, okay, my 5-year-old car has learned how to drive itself. Imagine what they're pumping out of the factory today. And Seattle is like a very tricky, small roads, weird signs. And I would say like 90% of the time I'm on FSD. Like, I like driving, but it's crazy to me how useful on my 5, and I think I'm on hardware 3. Mm-hmm. So I'm not even on the newest computer chip. So that's what kind of boggles my mind of the FSD technology. And to me, it's like in the bag for Tesla now, just because I've seen it on such old hardware. But
yeah, I watched some of your very first drives with it, and I remember you trying to hit the wall in the, what's that big?
Oh, the monorail test. Yeah.
You're trying very hard to hit that wall. I was thinking to myself, this is one very timid drive.
Yeah. No, and I mean, it learned how to do the monorail test and everything, but... And actually, I was thinking one thing on the data side of like these massive data centers. Mm. We've never seen Elon raise this much money and invest it. And I know it's more for XAI, but then you can see the numbers. Like, yeah. SpaceX raised, you know, 10 or 15 billion its whole life. Yeah. Then for XAI, he raises like 6 billion like this and like spends it immediately.
Yeah.
So we'd never seen him raise that much capital that quickly to deploy. So that's an interesting like barometer of how, you know, the conviction he had in that opportunity and like how important it was. It was like, I'm going to catch up to Sam Altman and like buy even more than him from NVIDIA. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
A strong signal.
Yeah. He has the instinct that, you know, more is better. And, you know, and so I think, you know, if you think about his instincts when it comes to technology, they're amazing. And so he has had the instinct and he's pursued it, and I think it's going to prove good. And by the way, That's one of the reasons that I'm so opposed to this idea of marrying XAI with Tesla.
Oh, you're opposed?
Absolutely opposed.
And what's why? Because why?
Because of the capital needs that XAI places. It would just sink the public stock. It would be very difficult to keep going to the public markets for billions, almost trillions, but billions upon billions, hundreds of billions of dollars over a short period of time. They've only got $39 billion or so, something like $39 billion in the bank. That XAI would suck that up in, you know, in a year.
Wow.
And so the stock would tank.
Maybe. But isn't the flip side, they're like perfectly fitting puzzle pieces of like Tesla's cash flow going like this, XAI needing all that cash. So instead of selling out to other random investors, like, is that not, there's a perfect like cash flow match,
in your mind,
you would say.
In your mind, that may be true. But if you actually time it out on a graph, you'll see that Tesla's big cash flow gusher is not going to happen till late next year, maybe even the following year. By that time, you'd have needed another $100 billion for XAI, and so you'd have to go to the capital markets probably three times next year.
Interesting. So you think he's going to put that level of money into XAI?
Like, absolutely, without question.
Wow. No, and I see that point. And that also, what you said is another interesting thing of, when does robo-taxi start to produce cash?
Yes.
You know, like, that's something that I think is very interesting. We were talking about on our ride, and what about deploying with CapEx all those vehicles? That's 3 or 4 years of just the network gets bigger and bigger. Like, the cash flow, they're investing in the network. So I don't see them. Yeah, I guess I'm talking my way out of my first point, because I'm like, yeah, they're going to need cash. I don't even think late next year they're making cash from this, really.
When you think about the puzzle pieces, they fit like a glove. Absolutely fit like a glove. But when you actually look at the cash demands,
yeah,
you go, oh my God, this could be a catastrophe. Look, they're having this is the best. We've been through the best capital markets of any lifetime. In the ZERP years, you know, in those ZERP years, you couldn't throw enough capital at some of these companies. But if you look at what's happened in the last year, 2 years, you can't throw enough money at AI, as long as they're private companies.
Or NVIDIA.
Yeah, NVIDIA is in a different class, because they're making hardware and making profits out of the hardware. They're making cash flow.
They have a flywheel.
Investment.
They yeah.
have a flywheel already. They're about 3 years ahead of the software market.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see how they are printing billions and everyone else is losing billions, essentially paying them. Like,
that's literally, that's where the money's going.
Yeah,
it's to NVIDIA.
They're rolling in money from AI.
The flow is from private markets
into
the big model companies, the LLM companies, and from them
into NVIDIA. Yeah.
That's the flow. And so the last thing you want to do at this point is marry Tesla to one of those companies. But fast forward 2 years, and you could pretty much zip those companies together. In fact, you may even want to zip, you know, SpaceX into that company, because the cash gusher from those, you know, could be what he needs combined to put into Mars. But we did a model of Mars, and then
we posted it.
We did a model of Mars, and Mars is going to be, you know, a huge cash sink.
What are we talking?
Infrastructure. It'll be very profitable, like XAI and like Tesla.
But it'll be trillions of...
It'll be a trillion of cash flow.
You think a trillion to put in to get to Mars?
Yeah.
Wow.
And get the self-sustaining civilization going, and having an actual like operation up there you can generate cash flow from. For sure. Yeah. I mean, you have to.
No, it's so interesting, because ARK put out that model of valuing SpaceX.
That's the one. He had ARK. So he had ARK and a gentleman from Mach 33.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He hosted them on a podcast, and we posted it on the channel. So make sure y'all go check it out.
I'm supposed to do a podcast with them soon, too, about the similar, like, trying to unpack, because I thought it's so interesting to think about.
You should look at ours and come up with your views, but we
and like and subscribe when you watch it.
Yeah.
it'd be a hoot to have Gotti watch one of my.
Oh yeah, it would be fantastic. Yeah. Maybe you should start a Patreon so he can return the favor.
Yeah. I'm gonna subscribe. I'm Larry's number one fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's my view.
Yeah.
So, really cool.
What's interesting about that? So then, where does the bot fit into this? Right.
By the way, can I have a moment?
Yeah.
Just to dump on Gary Black.
Of course.
I mean, my good friend Gary.
Love you, Gary. The best. You, Gary. No, yeah, he's great. Seriously, he is great. Great guy. Yeah.
I mean, he wanted to give back.
But.
He wanted to give back money. He wanted to buy back shares. You know.
Yeah.
I don't think we have enough money in the bank yet. I just don't think we have enough money in the bank at Tesla. And so I'm very pleased that we were able to avoid that. And, you know, just
the buyback.
Just another reason to really, you know, be so thankful for the stewardship of Elon Musk. Anyway.
Yeah. But so that's interesting you bring that up, though, because if we fast forward a little bit, then the bot is going to require a giant amount of compute as well for it to operate at a high level. Absolutely. Right? So Tesla is going to have the same conundrum that XAI has. And we know Cortex 2, a lot of that compute is also going to be used to train the bot. But the bot, the amount of variables it has to work through to be operational in every domain, it's like thousands of times greater than the car, right? Because the dimensions it can move on, like each finger, the wrists, the elbows, the arms, the shoulders, the hips, the knees, the foot, right? All of these require their own neural nets as an output, right? Whereas in the car, it's like left, right, forward, backwards.
You've got...
Right?
Yeah, you've got, you know, a handful of degrees of freedom.
21, I believe. Just a hand.
No, a handful of degrees of freedom in the car.
Oh, I see what you did there.
You've got almost an unlimited number of...
Yeah, degrees of freedom in the body.
Freedom in the body, just in the hand alone.
Yeah.
So here you've got a handful, but here you've got, you know, you're full of hands.
I think the hand is 21 degrees, and then the car is like 5, right? More. Or maybe more. Maybe, but the hand itself has at least 4 times more degrees of freedom than the car. Just the hand. And then you have, on top of that, you have to build in the wrist, the elbows, the shoulders, and how they all play together. So like the compute need for the bot, you know?
Just really. Get to 5 in the car.
Or 4, whatever.
Forward, black, left, and right.
Yeah, 4. Yeah, yeah. And then the music.
No, you can't.
I don't know.
You can't fly.
Yeah, you can't fly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, 4 degrees of freedom, right? Left, right, forwards, and backwards. Yeah, it's in a 2D plane, right?
Yeah.
So I'm curious, when do you guys think the bot will come out then? Because it seems like it's been advancing rapidly. But then if you're putting this metaphor of like, that's how many degrees, it's like, well, then it's not going to come out till the 2030s and require like hundreds of billions. But they're making a lot of progress on it now. So it seems like they're somewhere in the middle of like...
Yeah, there's different tiers. Like the way I view it, you tell me if I'm thinking about this incorrectly, Larry. The way I view it is that there's different tiers of difficulty and value you can bring from that motion, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So picking up things and putting them down is a very common task. Like if I'm thinking about it from my supply chain warehouse days, picking, packing, put away, transporting material from place to place, working a hand jack, et cetera, that is like, it's not the hardest job in the world, like from a mechanics perspective, but it's an extremely useful one. And it is one where the human does go under a lot of strain, because try working a 12-hour shift when it's 100 degrees in a warehouse that's not air conditioned. It's fucking brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, it is insanely difficult, right? But the bot doesn't have feelings. We don't have to be quote unquote humane with the bot. So we can work that thing into the ground and it can do the same type of, and I hate putting it in sort of that framing, but that's what's going to happen with these humanoid robots. That's where the value from these humanoid robots comes from, is doing tasks that for humans would typically be brutal, right? In those tasks, the motions are not that difficult. Like the amount of variability, like versus being a construction worker or being a landscaper or working on a deep sea fishing boat, right? If you think about all these different human, like those are way more difficult and they require a lot more. But picking up stuff, putting it down, picking product, putting it in a box, closing the box, putting it in the truck, or even in a factory line, like just doing repetitive motions over and over again, it doesn't seem like they're going to require that much compute to become useful.
You can, the word for it, the expression for it is the three D's.
Yeah, yeah.
Dirty, drudgery,
yeah.
Dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly right. Exactly.
What it can do, you know, from the outset.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, it's not going to pick up your baby and, you know,
right.
Take
it. Sing it a lullaby and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure I would want a robot to do that, to be completely honest. Like, there are certain, like, use cases where, like, a robot...
I'm getting to the age I want a robot to pick me up.
That's fair. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's totally fair. But I think that's where... And part of me, you know, like, there was this debate from a few months ago where... I forget who said this, but somebody said, like, they made a bet with me. I can't remember if I accepted it or not. Remind me if I did. If I did, I'm sorry. I forgot it. I'll make sure to pay you if you're right. They said that Tesla will make positive cash flow on the bot before they do on the robotaxi, because the okay, so why do you think that is?
You know, the positive cash flow,
I think it was Nick actually,
on the robotaxi happens almost instantly. It starts working because the margin of profit is so high. So you know, you don't calculate the capital cost and then your margin, then your cash flow calculates against that capital investment. You know, amortize your capital investment. So if you're earning $2 or $3 a ride, $2 or $3 a mile from the outset, and Waymo's getting close to four, or is over four, then you're at profit almost immediately, as long as you're doing, you know, couple of hundred miles a day
without a safety rider.
Without a safety rider.
Yeah.
Well, actually, even with a safety rider, those prices.
You might. Money. Yeah, you're right. You might break even, maybe. Yeah.
No, you're actually making money.
Okay.
$4 a mile. You're definitely.
Okay. Making. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I would say that he's wrong. Now, if he takes the total capital and rate, you know, as cash flow. As
yeah, the cash flow, flow. Yeah, yeah.
Then that's a different matter. But I don't think that's... I think you've got to keep your capital and your cash as
separate. Yeah, thing. Separate thing.
So they'll be pumping earnings with this quickly then, according to your calculation. Because that's a thing where, like, I'm not giving them the benefit of the doubt on that, just on, like, some old school principles kind of thinking of, like, you paid 50 G's for the car, like, okay, you're going to put 48,000 on the balance sheet while you do rides, like, yeah. We still outflowed that cash. So from an investor perspective, right?
That's a whole different world. That's like changing accounting forever.
Well, not changing accounting, but just realizing that these earnings come with a massive cash flow. They're looking different on the cash flow statement than the income statement.
Capital investment.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't borrow the capital to make the investment, I mean,
yeah, yeah.
So it would be GAAP profitable. So under GAAP, if
not
they're...
Not only GAAP profitable, but also cash flow profitable. Look, when you invest money, when you invest $20 billion into your factories, as Tesla have done,
yeah,
they don't take that off the cash
right.
flow in the quarterly statements. They take it off the capital. They've got, you know,
got it.
Or loans.
Got it.
So, you know, let's not confuse... You know, earnings, revenue, and cash flow.
Got it.
With capital and capital investment.
Got it.
Source of.
So cash flow will be basically unchanged when they allocate inventory that's coming out of the factory to the robotaxi network, and then they can start generating cash flow from that capital,
that's
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like buying equipment and machinery.
Makes perfect. Yeah, that makes sense. So that's very interesting then, because the second the safety rider is yanked and then they have a big enough geofence area with enough cars that are doing $2 per mile,
yeah.
You can immediately go on the P&L and show, okay, here's a robotaxi revenue and profit, and they can show a profit.
I would be amazed if they started at $2 a mile. I think they're going to start at closer to $4 a mile, maybe $3 or $4 a mile.
Because they could, right? Because they're...
Because they can.
Yeah.
Because they don't have enough cars on the road. You know, the $2 a mile, when you get down to the $2 a mile and below, it's because you have masses of cars on the road. They can get down to $1 a mile, says ARC, in 2025. I have no doubt that they will get there. None at all. But they will not start at $2 or $1 a mile.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Elon. So Elon has got...
You know, I mean, if they do...
A computer that's many times the size of mine, and he could.
If they do, they better have 2,000 cars in the region. Because the demand for that service would be unbelievable. Right?
Yeah, you won't be able to buy a car because it'll be high demand.
Yeah, like everybody's like, I'll just take a robotaxi to the airport. Why would you know?
Yeah, I mean, as it turns out, they have the resources to put 2,000 cars.
Yeah, exactly.
2,000 cars.
Yeah,
they have the cars available. I mean, you can go to any service center of Teslas, in delivery center of Teslas, and you're going to see 100 cars.
Yeah.
In that delivery center.
And every day they get turned.
Yeah.
And then 2 days of that at the Austin service centers is equivalent to the fleet that Waymo has in Austin right now.
That's right.
Which is like 15% of the total fleet that Waymo has.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
People don't understand the scale that Tesla's at. And by the way, that's just kind of considering Model Ys.
Correct. So, not Model 3s or Cybercabs.
Yeah. Cybertrucks.
So, okay, to close the loop on the financing, do you think, I guess this is the way I'm framing it, do you think the cash balance goes through a period of decreasing? That $39
billion, absolutely.
Will that dip for a few quarters? And what's the trajectory of the balance sheet look like?
I think we're going to get down to, unless they go to the capital markets, and they can. I mean, Tesla could raise $100 billion on their current balance sheet. From
like sell stock?
No.
Or debt?
Debt.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. And you know, once they've verified and absolutely, I don't want to use the word certified, once they've verified the market and made sure that the cars that they buy are going to return cash immediately, there's nothing to stop them borrowing, $100 billion in the marketplace once they have that verification. But I would expect to see the cash start dipping quite dramatically in 2025. I could see this.
Interesting. See, that's where I was getting at with the earnings, because it's interesting that you're saying cash will go down, yet our GAAP earnings will increase.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of like a big difference from what we've had on Tesla's income statements in the past, where it's like they're making money. But now you kind of got to add this other layer of.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So the capital, the available capital is going to shrink as they deploy the capital. As they deploy the cash into capital goods, which is the fleet.
Yeah.
And they've not had a fleet before. They've not had to have a fleet. What they've had is inventory. And the inventory moving up or down has had a cash impact. But now they're going to have, capital goods. Instead of equipment that they put into their factories, they're going to have cars that go out into the road. Now, if you look at Waymo, they have to put something between $60,000 at the lower end to about $160,000 or more that they have been spending to put a car on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla have to put in something like $35,000, $38,000 per car. And shortly, which is to say when Cybercab starts production, that's going to shrink dramatically. Some say to below $20,000. It could be $22,000 per vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will shrink their cash. But that doesn't mean their cash flow goes down. The cash flow is what those cars are earning.
Yeah. And at that point, if you don't have a safety rider, you're paying for insurance, charging, maintenance, cleaning, miscellaneous, right, at that point. What? How are you thinking about the? Yeah, the insurance, like what I've been trying to do a little bit of math around this. So
they're going to be self-insured except for liability.
Okay, you think liability they will go to the markets?
I don't know which company is going to provide that liability. Whatever Waymo is doing, you know, Tesla's going to do. Tesla doesn't have as big a balance sheet as Waymo's parent company.
Yeah.
Although I believe that Waymo's got now minority shareholders, so.
Yeah, Waymo's like its own, right? Are they kind of spinning it out, sort of?
Google still has a majority share, is my understanding. I don't know much about it.
But the outside investors was interesting, because it's like, it almost seems like it's not like part of Alphabet. It's almost like they've moved it into a subsidiary owned by Alphabet that they fund and let other people come into.
Yeah, which means they have to carry insurance. You know, some sort of separate.
Do we know what the rate is for Waymo from an insurance perspective?
We do not.
And they keep that on the wraps.
I would love to see their financials. Yeah. That would be so, if Waymo was a public company, that would be fascinating to look at how they're doing it.
I mean, I've heard a lot of, I think the All In guys were saying that they should break out Waymo and then have it be its own entity so they can raise cash and actually like, so.
Why do they need to raise cash? They got more.
With Google, right? Yeah, I know. Yeah.
That was a counter indication when I saw them do that, because I was like, well, if you're thinking about this from ROI, like, I don't want to give up my robotaxi business at $30 billion valuation. I think they sold it, so I don't know what valuation they sold. But it was like, you know, you would think Google, seeing all the data, would want to pour in that cash flow. But,
you know, I didn't know that they're very profitable. I didn't know that the cash flow is very good. You know, if you have to buy your car, well, somewhere north of $60,000 and as high as $200,000. I mean, you know, we've seen the numbers. The numbers are very clear. The cost of the car has a big impact on the cash flow. Big impact, certainly with these small numbers of vehicles on the road.
Right.
And the kind of build out that they have to do. So, you know, I don't think it's a great business yet.
It's not a great business because they aren't able to make enough cars to run their own service. They have to go on Uber because they don't have enough cars to run their own app and go far enough.
Enough cars, it's just the amount of cash.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. It's like it's economically, it's almost unfeasible because it's so expensive and complex. And the supply chain and the manufacturing base doesn't exist for them to get enough cars in Austin to have their own app.
But here's the number that floored me. They're setting up a factory.
Yeah.
It's not their own factory.
Zeekr, right? The Chinese company.
No, it's a subcontractor setting up a factory to import these cars and to do the customization.
Yeah.
And they're going to do the sum total of 2,000 cars next year.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, and Tesla's made that many today.
How is that a business?
Yeah, exactly. It goes back to my original point. Is that the leading competitor to Tesla makes as many cars per year that Tesla does in a day, and that is unsustainable. That directly impacts their ability.
Gary says that's not the leading competitor. He says that every car, every vendor out there is going to have autonomy.
Great. How many are they making per year?
Every vendor, so.
Oh, like GM, Toyota. Okay, where are they?
Well, and the flip side is, the cars are not what's holding it back, which is so interesting. 1,500 Waymo is doing like $250 million in revenue.
Yeah.
So 2,000 Waymo is actually a lot, like for the self-driving network. Yeah. Like it's not like Tesla's like, oh, we're gonna put in 500,000 all our production next quarter and that'll crush it on the network. They couldn't if they wanted.
Right.
Like Tesla still has this, like their biggest barrier to the limiting factor, shout out to Jordan. Is, you know, the ability to not have safety drivers and not be monitoring. Can you have one person monitoring 10 cars, 50, 100 cars, like we were talking about?
Yeah.
That's still such the limiting factor for Tesla. So it'll be interesting. But to like you're saying, it's like, it's a done deal. Like they can build the cars for cheap, they're ready for that. But they're in other ways, they're not ready, which is, I think, kind of interesting.
There's another limit factor we haven't mentioned here. And that is, until NHTSA or until the Department of Transport more particularly promulgates a federal standard.
Yeah, the framework.
A federal framework. They have to go city by city.
State by state,
By state.
Yeah.
So...
And so, okay, and we were talking about this in the car. This is what's so fascinating about the situation where we're in now, because Elon is betting on that happening, because he's not going all in on we're going to make every car with a steering wheel and pedal in case we aren't able to get the approvals. He shifted the entire company to say, screw it, driverless, all in.
You know my theory on that?
What?
My theory is he didn't do that now. He did that 2 years ago.
And that's why he got into politics?
I don't think that's why he got into politics, because I believe what he says about why he got into politics. But here's the thing. If you read Walter Isaacson's book, you know that they had this meeting.
Yep.
You know, and they had this meeting and the management persuaded him to, you know, have this backup plan with the steering wheel and so on. And I keep telling people that what people don't, what they don't realize is, in fact, he didn't agree with them. He let them think they were getting their own and that he was agreeing with them. And within 6 months, he had this great purge.
Yeah. That's what we were talking about. Like, I think a lot of the executives wanted him to focus on the $20,000 whatever.
Exactly.
And he was like, I don't care. I'm not building the van and all this stuff you think you need. Like, which is so Elon, you know, to just be like, disruption, pace of innovation.
Crazy.
We read the same facts. We read the same facts. He just made up his mind and he went along to go along because, you know, he didn't want to disrupt it. But within 6 months, he disrupted. He just fired the guys and just moved on and made the decision.
Yeah, he's
shut
like,
down the whole Mexico factory thing, shut down the whole Model 2, just said, this is where we're going. No steering wheel.
So do you think Tesla runs a massive risk of their cash flow being impacted in the coming years because the regulation, there's a chance that it won't catch up with their ability, like it won't catch up with Elon's production build out for a fully driverless car, and Tesla's going to be rendered with a ton of idle capacity and a bunch of CapEx that's just sitting there, and they're not going to have enough cars selling into the market that has a steering wheel and pedal that's going to fund their robotaxi rollout and their bot rollout.
There's several stages in my answer. There is a political risk that this administration does not get voted in next, that this government gets thrown out and a Democratic government comes in. And
as early as the midterms.
I don't think the midterms matter. I think the president, president matters, because it's the administration that will make the change. So that's one great risk. The second great risk is that there's a catastrophe. Two people killed.
Like accident. Yeah. And you know the media is...
Oh, yeah.
That's the problem. They're
trying.
Yeah, they're trying when nothing goes wrong.
Yeah.
To make it look bad. And we've all been so...
Yeah.
This has been like the media's final chess move.
Yeah.
I think.
But remember, there is going to be an accident and somebody is going to get killed.
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable. So the question is when and what are the details around that story and... How does the company deal with it, and how does the government deal with it? So that's the second great risk. And the third great risk is, you know, if the rollout gets administratively or operationally imperfect, if it's rolled out imperfectly, if there's really bad service, if there's really bad operate, you know, if it doesn't go smoothly the way this launch has gone.
Yeah.
So there are probably some other risks that I haven't really, you know, but these are the great risks. These are the really big ones.
Yeah, 100%.
In some ways, I think it's like Tesla's bet the company again, just like they did with the Model 3.
Absolutely.
They bet the company on the cyber cabin autonomy. Yeah. And I do think there's a level of higher risk, higher reward with that decision.
Yes.
And we're in a period of higher, like, it's like, okay, we're worth $1.1 trillion with like $85 billion in flatlining revenue.
Exactly.
So, and like a low margin product. So we're getting all this leeway, but if one thing happens, like the market's valuing this business that doesn't exist. So if that idea of that imaginary business gets impacted by whatever operational hiccup happens, it's going to be, it could get ugly.
Wait, a robo-taxi death will have a gigantic impact.
Or even
on
a
the,
crash.
Yeah, or some sort of...
Shut it down for a month. Yeah. And that's why the politics worries me too, just because of the like democratic people's like like ability to jump on that and then make Elon the villain and make Tesla the villain.
Yeah.
So that...
He's out there stealing your jobs, creating driverless vehicles, and out there killing people and being unsafe.
They're dangerous.
Like, it just writes itself.
Tesla's are dangerous. It writes itself.
So it's like, I do think we're in a period of a little bit of high risk. You know, Elon.
I think that's a great observation.
And that you can see that in the stock price. These massive moves up and massive moves down.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you get the hawkish and then the dovish and then the oh my god-ish things going on. And so, and you know, I spoke to a German influencer, a guy who runs Tesla Welt. You know,
he's a Rob Mauer of Germany.
Rob Mauer of Germany.
Yeah. Make sure you go check him out.
Yeah. And he said to me, you know, Tesla in Europe is kind of deadish, you know?
I mean, like people don't like it.
And that's been purely politics.
Hmm.
So, you know, the level of risk that Elon is prepared to tolerate for his business is very hard for a public company to tolerate.
Yeah.
But, you know, he brings, you know, great, you know, capabilities with all the, there you are. So these risks are there and you have to be very, very risk tolerant to invest in the stock, even though we all believe these great things may happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think we've covered the risks quite.
I think we did. I think we actually covered a lot.
My last hot take idea on this is I think it could be good marketing. Like no such thing as bad press. We've heard that. And I kind of think that's what's happening with Tesla right now in America in a weird way, is like there was all this Tesla hate, but deep down, even liberal people know the media news is bullshit.
Yes.
And now they've heard Tesla's name a gazillion times more. And now it's like all eyes are on Tesla before they unveil their coolest thing they've been working on that's you're going to love no matter what.
100%.
So now it's like, okay, everyone knows Tesla. Tesla came out the Robotech. It's like, oh, Elon, the crazy tech gazillionaire guy who's always scheming on something new. Of course he came out with the coolest thing. Like it makes sense. So 100%. My flip side of like the high risk moment is like, I'm hoping that's like my optimistic arc of how the story plays out is like, this all becomes a memory and people forget like Elon Trump, whatever. It's like, he's the guy who brought the robotaxi.
And Elon,
like, we don't care about the Trump thing, 100%. Hopefully.
And Elon operates best under massive amounts of pressure and massive amounts of attention. I think in his arc, he's had his greatest moments when him and his team especially, because they're the ones that are you know, taking Elon's direction and executing against it when they're put by, you know, between a rock and a hard place. You know, the fourth rocket launch to make sure SpaceX is alive. Boom. Model 3 ramp, the company's weeks away from bankruptcy. Boom, right? And I think there's another thing, too, about this sort of media landscape that we're in now, too. All the negative press and all the crazy attention on the company, in a way, is a fantastic, like, I've been told I use forcing function a lot, but I'm going to use the word anyway, the term. It's a giant forcing function for the company to execute at a high level because they know they have to execute at a high level. Because they know that if there's any missteps or safety mishaps or if there's any error in the way they roll this out, knowing that they've given us all access to record and show and knowing that we're all going to show what we experienced, we're not going to hide anything from the public, we're going to show it, they know that they have to cross their T's, dot their I's, and then go above and beyond to make sure this is an absolutely killer product. And so far, even with the hiccups, in my opinion, I think the trend is there. Where the product exists, the service exists. It's all three of us have taken plenty, between the three of us, we've taken like 30 rides or something in the last few days, right? And outside of a couple hiccups that are related to just corner cases, nothing was unsafe. It was just kind of stupid behavior. But outside of that, it has been flawless, and it's been so comfortable. It's been reliable. It's been consistent. It is, in my opinion, one of the best ways to get around from point A to point B, because the car is essentially yours and it's customized to you. So that's what they have to capitalize on, is ensuring that that comes across fully, and that's what dominates the story. And the pressure from the media and the negative attention, and I know the team feels this, because when I used to work at the company, it was impossible to ignore the negative headlines. Because when you got home and your friend or your family called you, dude, you should sell your stock. Like, Elon's losing his mind. Like, you should leave the company right away. Like, you don't think these guys are hearing that from friends and family 24/7, right? So they know, it's like, no, I'm going to prove those motherfuckers wrong. I'm going to prove them wrong. And that's the kind of energy. And that's why I love the company so much, is because I know that fire exists in that company. That's how great products are created. That's how great services are created. Right. So I think this media landscape, in a weird way, actually helps Tesla. And I'm glad all these folks exist, trying to find the littlest thing about it. Because ultimately, if Tesla takes that seriously, they'll make the product better. And then all of a sudden, they have such a great product above everyone else's that it's literally impossible to compete with them, because they've been through the fire. They've been through the criticism. They've been through the crazy stuff, the crazy attention, and they've come out on the other side. The phoenix rises from the ashes, yeah, as they say.
Sorry.
Say hallelujah.
Yeah, yeah.
Hallelujah.
I get lost in this stuff, but yeah.
I think that's a great note to end on.
Yeah, I agree. Anything? Any parting thoughts?
No, I love that.
No,
I'm fired up. This is a big start of a new era. Fired up to be in Austin with you guys.
Likewise, man. It's so
documenting
fun.
Documenting what it feels like.
Heck yeah. Where can people find you?
HyperChange. YouTube on HyperChange, or on X, Galley.
Oh, Maverick Mind.
Yes.
I'm on YouTube, and I'm on X as Larry, Tesla Larry.
Yeah, and we have some incredible guests lined up for Maverick Mind that we're not going to spill the beans on.
Yeah, we're not going to spill
Yeah, the beans. But boy, I'm excited. thank you all very much. I hope this was informative and helpful. Like, subscribe, check these guys out. I never know how to end these things, so I'm just going to stand up and walk away. I just don't.